From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast. It's episode 29 for Friday, the 10th of June, 2011. On the show this week is this. And this. And this. And of course, some of this.
You might ask, why should I believe them? They're the ones that brought me Mobile Me.
Yes, this was the week of geekish double fisting as E3, the world's biggest video games conference, and WWDC, Apple's annual new shiny things conference, kicked off side by side. So we'll be delving into the latest explosive, emotive, and gesticulative video game news whilst finding out what's new with Apple, space, Norwegian metal, and pandas. Hello. I'm Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me for a unicorn meat sandwich this week is senior staff writer Duncan Gear.
Hello, hello, how are you?
And fine. And also our now associate editor, Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
Back from Australia.
Indeed. All right. G'day. Just a few things I picked up.
All that. And also the critically acclaimed, genre-busting, axe-wielding Mark at British Gaming Brown.
Hello.
Hey,
what's,
Mark.
What's the whole At British Gaming thing about? I think I've never really asked you that.
Okay, so we had a blog called British Gaming. That was the Twitter account. Then I had my own Twitter account, but it was never as popular. So I stole it when the website just died.
Well, for those that don't recognise Mark's name, Mark is one of our daily news writers who's come all the way down from, I think as far as 60 minutes away from Buckinghamshire. To talk about some of our E3 stuff. We've been covering E3 all through the week as the gaming show has gone on. So we're going to talk a little bit later about E3. Anyway, for the time being, I want to talk about iCloud.
I bet you do.
Of course I do. I have a watch right now that's an iPod Nano an iPod Nano watch case. Look at that.
It does look quite good. And you know I'm not a massive Apple fan, but I think that does actually look pretty awesome.
I redefine
what
it is to
have wrists. I think it looks awesome until you realise what it is. And then it's fundamentally unacceptable.
Kind of
douchey. I've heard that before. So Apple announced iCloud earlier this week, which is its kind of, as we suspected, replacement to Mobile Me. It contains a number of cloud services, you know, contacts, address book, calendar, email, all that kind of stuff. But one of the most interesting things that it's going to bring is this service called iTunes Match, which is basically your iTunes library mirrored in the cloud that you can stream to all of your devices at the same time for about £20 a year or something like that.
Well, kind of.
Kind of, yeah. So you'll be able to, any songs that you've bought on iTunes will be mirrored in there. Any songs you haven't bought on iTunes, iTunes later this year will scan your entire library on your computer, and any songs that it detects that is also in the iTunes store, you can then stream from the iTunes store.
And this is what it's paid an alleged $150 million to the record labels for.
In advance, yeah. Which I think is pretty amazing because it's kind of the most interesting aspect about this is the fact that if you have bought these CDs, this music, or whether you just stole them from BitTorrent or ripped them from friend CDs, this is in a way giving the record industry a way to make some money because you're paying for the subscription fee to stream back what you've already got on your computer somewhere in the world.
Or from another perspective, I've bought these CDs. Why do I have to pay to stream them to my computer again?
But Duncan, on the functionality side, does this not meet some of the criteria that you had for a kind of cloud?
Yeah, I mean, it meets the whole scanning thing. I think is really good, and it's good that they've done that. I think they've paid through the nose for it. But that was on my early this year. I wrote a list of things that a cloud music service would need to have, a storage locker would need to have for me to be happy with it. And one of those things was not having to upload all your MP3s, just it being able to scan your library, recognize them, and that would be it. So I'm pleased about that. But then it doesn't go anywhere near far enough for my liking in all the other areas. And I've also heard that it's limited to 25,000 songs. Is that true?
I've heard that mentioned, but I'm not sure how many people have more than 25,000.
Well, quite a lot of hardcore music fans, the kind of people who'd be paying for this.
I have about 15,000 in my library.
I think I've got about 40 or 50,000.
Liv, do you care? Do you
not
reckon
particularly.
Something? Well, this is going to come out in probably about the autumn, along with iOS 5, the new iPhone OS, which has a load of new features, new notification systems and stuff like that. And also OS 10 Lion, which is the next Mac OS operating system, which we've already covered kind of in the past, so we're not going to go over that too much today. But we've got plenty of stuff on wired.co.uk if you're interested. Let us know what you think to iCloud, though, podcast@wired.co.uk. Mark, you wrote a story about Facebook letting other people tag you if a photo you have looks like you. That wasn't really very clear. Make it clear to me.
Well, essentially, when you upload a picture to Facebook now, it will sort of scan people's faces and try and find who it is based on face recognition technology and say, hey, is this Duncan? Have you uploaded 800 pictures of Duncan? We can do that for you. But it's spurred a few privacy concerns because you're not given pre-approval if someone tags you.
Yeah, so it's the typical Facebook thing of opt out. Like, we're going to turn this on, and if you don't like it, then wade through 7 pages of options and turn it off.
But yeah, so you can opt out of it, right?
Yes, you can make it so that Facebook basically deletes your face from their face recognition library.
From their book.
Yes, which, from their Facebook, from their book of faces.
Which I've already done. Now, Liv, you were saying that one of your friends was confused with a piece of sushi.
Yeah, well, she uploaded a whole load of photos, and one of the photos happened to be of a piece of sushi, and the facial tracking software can't be that sophisticated because it itemized this piece of sushi and asked who this person was. Thankfully, it didn't have a suggested person. But I think it's really good. I mean, at the moment, I'm going to a lot of weddings. I'm taking photos of the same two people, like 60 photos of them. And actually, to have this tool makes life a lot easier when you upload photos to Facebook.
So you reckon the sort of positives outweigh the negatives?
I think so. I mean, if they started then trying to, I don't know, sell advertising or kind of produce something weird that would like have my face in it in an ad, I'd probably start to freak out.
Well, the whole idea behind this is that it's not tagging you. It's basically saying to your friends, this looks like this person, is it? And if you say yes, it is that person, then your name is tagged.
And they've been doing that for a while with the kind of, they've had this little box in the top right corner where they've said, tag this person, is this so-and-so? And you can kind of say yes or no. Mm. And it's a kind of slightly predictive. But this is kind of widespread now.
What I found absolutely hilarious was the Metro had a front page cover story about this. And their headline was something ridiculous, like Facebook knows what your picture looks like and it's hunting for more.
That's fair enough. Isn't it?
Well, hunting for more?
All right, it's a bit hyperbolic.
Facebook wants your face.
Yeah, Facebook wants everything to do with you. I mean, I personally don't put any of my photos on Facebook. I hate being tagged, and I don't really like Facebook anyway. I use it because I want to know what my friends are doing, but I'm not really bothered about being tagged in photos. So I don't care. It's just another one of these things where it's kind of, we're going to switch on this service, and then you can opt out of it, which is a typical Facebook strategy.
Well, I mean, the thing is, from a usability point of view, if they didn't do that, then the vast majority of people wouldn't turn it on.
I'm not sure. A lot of people seem to be pretty keen on this idea.
But I don't think you could convince that many people to leap into the settings, which terrify most people already, and flick a switch that says, yes, I do want, you know, you to recognise my face in pictures.
The one thing they could do, which I didn't notice them do, was maybe when you logged in the next time to say, we've introduced a
new
feature.
Give you a notification,
I mean,
yeah.
I think when I first uploaded photos, they said, here's a new feature we're trying out. But it was a bit of a surprise when it happened for the first time. And I think they could have been a little bit clearer about it.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Oh, well, I don't think anyone seems to care too badly. I think this would be far worse if they were automatically tagging you and you had to go through and untag yourself. I think this is, to be honest, by Facebook standards, this is fairly, you know, innocuous and not too bad. But in some other Facebook news, the French have banned mention of Facebook and Twitter from news media because they think it gives undue prominence and is unfair on the competition, who may be smaller.
Yeah. Well, they haven't completely banned Facebook and Twitter. They've banned like news organizations saying, hey, go to our Facebook page or go to our Twitter profile. Mm. You know, they can still report on stories that directly involve Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, but the weird thing is that Facebook and Twitter have kind of become an extension of these news organizations. I mean, it's almost they consider it theirs and part, you know, another as if it was another channel or another, you know, radio station. And I think it's actually quite tricky for it to suddenly shift from that, I think. And I think that's what happens when you create a free service. You get all this amazing free PR, as Facebook and Twitter do. But then I suppose the likes of Bebo aren't benefiting from this, are they?
One commenter said that we should ban the words France and French from US media in response.
We spoke to Ofcom about this. We gave them a call and they were baffled by the whole thing.
They said they have no plans to enforce this here. It's basically just down to, you know, not giving undue prominence to one brand or the other. But saying follow us on Facebook is fine because, you know, that's what people do now.
I mean, there's already rules against giving undue prominence in media already in Britain. And so why don't you just apply that, you know, rather than just banning all mentions?
Well, we're going to take... No, we're not going to take a quick break. We've got one more story before we go. The internet has been declared a human right in a report from the United Nations, Liv.
Yeah, it was a report railed against France and the United Kingdom, which have passed laws to remove copyrights. Well, this is a weird sentence.
Three strikes sort of rules.
Yeah, it's to try and play against these kind of three strikes rules, but also following up from stuff that the Web Foundation's been pushing for years to try and, you know, get prevent things like Egypt taking the internet down.
The UN isn't saying that people can't be filtered and we can't have tiered internet if that happens or anything like that. This is about basically saying you cannot cut someone off from the internet.
Yeah.
They have a right to at least have access to it.
Yeah.
And we were talking earlier about whether being a human right meant that you have to be given it regardless of your, you know, social standing or, you know, finances or whatever. But this is more about you can't have it taken away.
Yeah.
Like you can't have your right to be taken away.
It's kind of semantics because the report didn't say that internet access is a human right, but it said that disconnecting people from the internet is a human rights violation.
Yeah, but isn't that quite interesting? Because you then start thinking about whether that means that we have an obligation to give everyone else, you know, the 75% of people of the world who don't have access to the web, give them access.
Well, the thing is, I mean, another basic human right is water. I mean, there are obviously people in loads of parts of the world who do not have access to water, or certainly don't have access to clean water and walk miles every day. It's still a human right. There's not much we can do about that.
But
really,
that's a priority of aid organisations as a result. Yeah. And, you know, will we be seeing, I mean, there are some aid organisations directed to set up web connections in extreme parts of the world.
And we have things like One Laptop Per Child, Nicholas Negroponte, who has basically said that computers and electronic learning aids like that are crucially important to raising people in the world now.
Yeah.
And it's kind of along the same lines, I guess.
And obviously it's not, you know, having access to Gmail or being able to see kitten videos. I mean, it is actually about being able to get jobs or being able to know where the nearest doctor is or be able to...
Or how much to sell your fish for.
Exactly. Or... And it's things that everyone takes for granted in some of the developed markets, but obviously...
I know exactly how much I need to sell my fish for.
Yeah, quite. How much?
£5.
There's another angle to this. And this comes after the stuff that we've seen in Libya, where governments in times of political unrest have basically switched off the internet. I mean, that wouldn't be something that would pass under this international law.
It would be a human rights violation.
Well, yeah, quite.
But the rapporteur sort of said quite specifically that it's about proportionality. And they said that regardless of the justification provided, including on the grounds of violating intellectual property rights, cutting somebody off from the internet is disproportionate. And it's basically a disproportionate punishment in terms of free speech and so on. And so it kind of falls under the right to free speech and free expression that is a human right.
How about this, though? What if Sky, if my connection to Sky, my web access goes, do I then get to kind of prosecute them for violating my human rights?
No.
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 Okay.
No. If anyone's wondering what the answer to that question is, no.
I think this could probably also have implications on the appeal, the judicial review against the Digital Economy Act, which is currently being pushed by TalkTalk and BT. When they lost the first round of judicial review earlier in the year, this wasn't out. But now that it's out, and specifically mentioning intellectual property, I think that could give them far more of a sway in their appeal than it did previously the first time round.
Definitely. Well, we're going to take a quick break now, and when we come back, we're going to talk about whether the panda is the squid of the sea. No, wait, other way around. Squid is the panda of the sea.
Wired magazine, now published digitally every month on iPad. Download the latest interactive issue, available now on the iTunes App Store.
The giant squid, the whale, the seahorse. Which marine animal should be the mascot for the conservation of the world's oceans? A group of biologists are proposing that it is the giant squid. King of the sea to some, enemy of...
So this is a group of biologists who reckon that in the same way that the WWF's iconic panda logo is associated with the preservation of endangered species on land, the giant squid should be adopted as the mascot for conservation of the world's oceans.
And this isn't the result of any kind of study. This is a group of people who have said, we need a mascot. It should be the squid because it's huge and endangered.
Well, yeah, I mean, they gave slightly more reasons than that. They said that, first of all, the giant squids are kind of, they fascinate the public. People are really taken by the idea of this sort of enigmatic creature from the deeps. They're seen widely in folklore, and they're one of the kind of iconic sea monsters that you always used to get in horror stories from boats.
These are all reasons why you don't want it as a mascot.
And there's also the species' ability to reflect the key concerns that are facing ocean ecosystems: overfishing, pollution, climate change, and acidification, all these things.
Liv, I know that you are not on board with this proposal.
I'm not. I mean, I just think that the mascot representing a movement has to be something that's unilaterally popular. People love the panda. They throw money at the panda despite its best efforts not to reproduce in any shape or form. But the giant squid, as Duncan just said, people are a bit scared of and repulsed by.
They're scared of it.
And I think there's so many other sea creatures that better represent creatures that people like and would pay money to. And I think things like the seahorse or even crabs or whales. I know you said that they didn't want necessarily to have a mammal because it wasn't fully representative of sea creatures.
Invertebrates account for more than 90% of known species in the world. And so picking an invertebrate is probably a more representative.
So if we were going to pick a cephalopod to represent the endangered species in the ocean, what would we pick?
I think a sweet octopus could be better.
A sweet octopus?
Yeah, but you know, like a friendly sweet, octopus.
Sweet octopus.
You can imagine him, like a rounded face, like little squidgy legs,
You could do that with a giant squid.
Not so much.
Does a giant squid only have one eye, or do I dream?
No, it has two.
I think it has two, but they're like the size of a dinner plate. They're big old eyes. It's all about the kind of the way that the species reflects the problems facing the oceans. I mean, a crab, it just scuttles about a bit. Yeah, sure, it's cute. It sings songs in a Caribbean accent. That's it.
No, seahorses are incredibly sensitive to fluctuations in sea temperature and, you know.
But are they sensitive to necessarily like pollution toxins in the same way that squid, because squid live so long, they accumulate biotoxins much, much more readily over a period of time.
I'm not saying that squid isn't affected worse by the problems of the ocean. I'm just saying that I don't think that means it has to be the mascot for it. I think the mascot should be something that people love and are willing to spend money on. And unfortunately, the squid, just like the shark, I think people don't like giving money to.
Personally, I don't want to throw money at the panda. I think they deserve to be extinct. You know, no matter how much we try, they will not reproduce. They only eat the hardest things in the world to find. Let's replace the panda.
Kind of off topic.
Well, okay. To be fair, though,
which do you think is better, a squid or a seahorse?
I would go for a squid purely for design aesthetic. You can do more in a logo with squid tentacles, whatever, with squid tentacles than you can with a seahorse.
Absolutely. Squid versus octopus.
I think the seahorse has the cute appeal.
Yeah. Mm.
The octopus, the squid is just sort of a big rubbery wet ball of slime.
You have to admit, it's the dark mysterious stranger of the oceans.
Well, we're very keen
but
to hear...
But I don't know if I'd give money to a dark mysterious stranger.
We're very keen to hear what you have to think. If you think that you know of a cephalopod that should represent the...
Or any other marine animal.
The hard done to of the sub... aqua world, then do email us podcast@wired.co.uk and we'll read out some interesting ideas and importantly arguments next week. But we have one more story to get to, and that is the fact that in Norway it has been suggested that diplomats are educated into the rich cultural history that is true Norwegian black metal. There's been a huge rise of global popularity of black metal, particularly over the last 10, 15 years, the last 20 years in total. And it's basically been suggested that, you know, if you're a diplomat and you're going around the world and you're doing all this, then you should know about the rich cultures of your country. And black metal is a very big part of Norwegian culture. Duncan, agree with this?
There's a strong argument that can be said that black metal is pretty much the soundtrack for modern Norway. I mean, the whole... you know, the kind of quite remote, quite, I don't know, help me out here.
Dark.
as quite a big black metal fan, you should...
I am, but I mean, I just think that the more world that's listened to black metal, the better. But I say that every day. That's why
this is basically about subcultures, isn't it? It's about metal subcultures developing all around the world. And black metal is one of the most extreme musical genres you can be into.
Yeah, it gets a lot more extreme. But
is the point that this is the strongest kind of local music type or musical export that Norway has?
It is. But Finland as well, and a lot of Scandinavia, you know, it's very, very, it's a hugely popular scene over there. I mean, one of the reasons you saw a band, who was it in the Eurovision Song Contest a few years ago?
Lordi.
Yeah, Lordi. I can't believe you knew that answer and I didn't.
I watch Eurovision every year without fail.
Yeah. The head of Norway's Foreign Ministry Centre, whose name I can't pronounce, but Duncan can.
Kjersti Somerset.
Told Norwegian a Norwegian newspaper I also can't pronounce.
I'm not going to try that one. Dagens Næringsliv.
We now have 116 Foreign Service missions, and they get many inquiries from people who want information about Norwegian black metal as a phenomenon. In the training programme, we have a large cultural programme in order to give the trainee a good understanding of Norwegian culture and the cultural industry. Black metal is clearly a part of this global awakening. That's enough from our news section from this week. And I want to move on and talk to you, Liv, because you went to a conference in Sydney last week.
I did, indeed.
The Vivid Sydney.
Vivid Sydney, yeah. It was Vivid Sydney and Creative Sydney. They were kind of two affiliated conferences looking at lighting installations, music, and kind of technology and ideas and the future. And I saw a lot of different things. Like, I was there for just 6 days, but they were jam-packed. And I wanted to tell you about some of the cool things that I saw there.
Yeah, so, tell me three. Give me three awesome things
okay,
that you saw.
Okay, three.
There.
So the first one is I went to a discussion about the rise of the citizen designer. And I think most people will be familiar with the idea of citizen journalism, where lots of web publishing tools have allowed anyone to set up a blog and kind of become a journalist. And in many cases, get more readership, better readership than some of the more established papers or media outlets. But the same is happening in the area of design. Things like 3D printing mean that you no longer have to source a manufacturer in China and make a huge bulk order of products to make them cheaply and quickly. You can now have one design, upload it to a website, and a 3D printer will print it off within, you know, a number of, well, minutes, if not hours, and you can sell that immediately. So anyone who has intentions to be a designer, has a basic kind of design skills, can suddenly start selling products very quickly and easily. And there's even tools in a website called Shapeways, which does a lot of these 3D printing, to convert a 2D drawing into a 3D printed object. So you can draw just a sketch of a pattern and they'll convert it into jewellery or kind of earrings or something.
And so what was the conclusion at the conference as to whether this is going to be the next big thing for in the same way blogging was?
Well, they said, I mean, I think they were a lot of designers speaking, so they were keen to maintain that there are key skills, CAD software and kind of design process that you need to be able to understand in order to be a designer. But I think this is going to give rise to a lot of people who might be amateur designers who are trained in design but don't have design businesses to be able to set up kind of sidelines in design.
It's certainly an area that we're seeing a lot of new trends in terms of 3D printing. There are a lot of companies, a lot of startups starting now to really basically print out anything that you can dream up and design.
Yeah.
We've had features in the magazine about various startups that do this, and we've had machines around like the MakerBot that can actually print its own components, so you
exactly.
can make more by printing off more printers, if you know what I mean.
And it's not just about 3D printing either. I mean, you've also got sites like Etsy, which have long been associated with these citizen designers that you were talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of the craftsmanship that goes into things that might go over and above something, say, like eBay, where there might not be that kind of element of personalization, you know, the understanding between the buyer and the seller that you get. You just want something cheaply. Whereas with Etsy, it's more about the craftsmanship and...
So what was the second cool thing that you saw?
Second cool thing was I went to one of the concerts. They opened up the Sydney Opera House for a lot of artists who they wouldn't normally have in an opera house. So they had the likes of Too Many DJs, they had The Cure, they had Bat for Lashes. But I went to see Chris Cunningham, who is he's an audiovisual artist, and he's done a lot of the videos for Bjork and Aphex Twin.
It's fair to say as well that they are not what you would call... conventional, nice music videos with like singing unicorns and smiles.
He plays with CGI, kind of really distorting people and creatures and parts of anatomy. And so it was this hour-long show in the Opera House, which is an incredible setting. And he played, it was kind of a 55 minutes of some of his best work. And it was a bit of an assault on the senses. I mean, it was incredible. The sound system was amazing. There was three projection screens with one central image and two kind of repeated side images. But I mean, some of the things I've seen, I mean, one of the examples was a little piece called Rubber Johnny, which is about this wheelchair-bound little alien creature who takes a load of drugs. It doesn't obviously say what kind of drugs it is. And then his body just morphs into extraordinary shapes. He's kind of tripping out in a mad way. And then on these two side screens, you just see really pornographic images and you get glimpses of bits of body and you're not quite sure what it is, but you know it's not nice. And
it's not a fingertip and a kiss,
but yeah, not one to take. Yeah, well, exactly. And so in some cases a kiss in a special place, but not one to take to gran or even mum.
I imagine it was quite of a shock when some people went to this conference, thought, I'll go to the Sydney Opera House, yeah. And they're seeing porn.
Basically, yeah. And everyone kind of was very quiet when he left. It was all everyone's a bit stunned.
Okay, well, stun me with your third and final most amazing thing from Vivid Sydney.
The third one is a bit stupid. It's a food item that I ate at this restaurant called The Key, and it was called the snow egg. And doesn't that just kind of conjure up an image of a little, something a unicorn might hatch out of? And when it arrived on the table, it genuinely looked like that might happen. It was this little kind of fishbowl with an egg sitting atop what looked like snow. And what actually the egg was made out of, the yolk was this ice cream, and that was surrounded by this kind of really marshmallow soft meringue, coated in this like hard, tough kind of shell, which had been blowtorched on, and it kind of shrink wrapped around the meringue. And then it was sitting, the snow was actually kind of a sorbet type thing. It's amazing.
How is that changing the world?
It's just a revolutionary dessert.
It's a treat for the mouth, isn't it?
It was a treat for the mouth in every sense.
It sounded like more than just a treat.
Yeah, it was pretty mouth orgasmic.
Well, we are going to move on to our main feature for this week before Liv descends into God knows what, where we're going to talk about E3.
Metal 01, stand by for new mission directive. Over. What's our next target? Multiple Russian warships near our ports. Proceed to harbor to assist. 5x5. Phase line echo secure.
So E3 was taking place this week. This is the Electronic Entertainment Expo that takes place every year. It's the place generally where all the three major console makers get together to show off the next 12 months of creations, Microsoft, Sony, Nintendo, and where we get to see all the latest, greatest games. So we're going to start with Microsoft. And Mark, what was the most important thing you learned from Microsoft?
That Kinect support will be in absolutely every Xbox 360 game ever made.
It did seem to be that Kinect was getting hacked into pretty much every major title that we saw. We saw it, in fact, for Mass Effect 3, where you could use the voice detection side of the Kinect to basically say the lines you want your characters to say in the game.
Sort of. You'd say the things that come up at the bottom of Mass Effect, like, you don't know what you're doing, but then Shepard would actually say something completely different, but along those lines.
Almost like a script. You're reading the script.
You're basically choosing the button you're going to press by reading it. You might as well be saying A.
Directing the conversation,
yeah.
Still.
It's a bit strange. They did this in a DS game called Phoenix Wright, where you're a lawyer and you could shout objection into it, but it wouldn't work half the time, so I hope it's better than that.
I imagine so. It seemed to work quite well on the stage, but these things tend to. Duncan, you bother about this? Do you want to voice control an RPG?
Well, I mean, I don't have a Kinect yet, so I haven't seen the full extent of its gloriousness. But at the same time, I'm not that fussed. I mean, it's kind of nice as an optional extra. And I think that's what it has to, you know, that's the key thing. It has to be optional. You have to be able to play Mass Effect without shouting out objection or whatever. You have to be able to do all these things without needing to have a Kinect.
EA, I know, was showing off a lot of games as well that utilize Kinect. So the next wave of sports games are going to come out with gesture support and things like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Golf, football, soccer, all those sorts of things.
So expect to break a lot of furniture. Mm. Also, I know Microsoft showed off the new Xbox dashboard, which got YouTube and things.
Yeah, it's going to have YouTube support. It's going to have Bing, which sort of isn't really like the internet Bing, but it searches all of Microsoft's different features like Hulu in America and YouTube. So you can search for like X-Men, it'll bring up X-Men games, X-Men movies.
How much do you bet that you'll have to shell out for an Xbox Live subscription to search for YouTube videos?
Probably, yes. And I mean, for all things like cloud support, you're definitely going to have gold. So I'm not going to be using any of those things.
And when's that going to be out?
The end of this year.
Okay, well, let's move into Sony. Sony was exciting Duncan almost unnaturally, I think.
Yeah, I'm not really a natural Sony fanboy, to be quite honest. So I've been very disappointed by most of the stuff they've done since the PS1, really, to be quite honest with you.
So which of Sony's flagpoles were you saluting?
the particular flagpole that I'm climbing up at the moment is the Vita, which is their next generation portable console, which basically has everything in it,
this
and it's really cheap.
This is the NGP that we talked about quite a while ago that they've now named the PS Vita.
Yes, that's right.
So, I'm very proud to showcase, for the first time in North America, the successor to the PlayStation Portable. What you've come to know as NGP, our next generation portable, is officially named PlayStation Vita.
It's got a quad-core chip, it's got 3G connectivity, it's got pair of cameras, it's got analog sticks, a touchscreen. It's kind of got everything you could want in a portable gaming device.
And a gesture control pad thing on the back of it, so you can use your fingers to do stuff on
to
the back.
To stroke
and manipulate.
And when it was announced, they were very coy about the price, and they gave very vague things. Everyone was sort of bracing themselves for, like, when the PS3 was announced and it was $600, that, like, it's going to be much. And then it came out as $249, which is the same as the 3DS, which is, I think, quite affordable.
Enormously low. And in fact, I think we've had some UK pricing since. Game and Play.com have both put it up £230 without 3G on Wi-Fi only and £280 with. That's pretty damn
That's
good.
Pretty competitive, particularly when you're competing with, say, the 3DS, and you've got this boatload of technology. I mean, this thing is a powerhouse. It's like a portable PS3 that does everything, and it's about £230.
And it'll have a bunch of PS3 games on it, is that right?
Yeah, there's going to be some games you can sort of use cloud, which is the word of the week, it seems, to save your save games onto the cloud and then play them on PS3, and you can play against PS3 people. So sort of trying to blur the lines there.
Did we hear much about the Move, the Sony PlayStation Move? Because it's sort of big push, and then no one seems to be talking about that.
Tacking it on, not as much as Kinect, but I mean, like, it works better with shooters than Kinect does, so it's going to be in, like, Resistance 3 and if there's a new Killzone and stuff like that.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to Nintendo. We talked a few weeks ago about the Nintendo Wii 2 that was kind of announced and unannounced. Not much detail came out. We now know that Nintendo's new console is going to be called the Wii U, and it comes with a controller that kind of looks like a small tablet with a control pad thing on it and a touch screen.
It looks like a Game Gear.
It looks like a Game Gear, or Sega Game Gear. It really does, with analog sticks. What is this?
So this is the new controller, and they do have a new console as well, which is a little white Wii-looking box. They didn't seem to show off at E3 at all. They just sort of had it in the background. So they have got a new console, which is sort of more powerful than the Wii, and it's going to have sort of Xbox 360-style graphics. And then they've got this controller thing with a big old stunken touchscreen in the center, which is used as like a sort of separate screen for menus and inventories. And you can tap a button and sort of stream the whole visual data straight onto the console, so you can sort of play it in bed or if someone's watching the baseballs.
Yeah,
on
so
the TV.
So you can sort of have a situation where you're playing on your Wii U and then your girlfriend or boyfriend comes in and says, I want to watch Desperate Housewives. Mm. And
you can say, giant controller.
Oh, okay. And then, like, just swoosh the screen down onto your controller.
See, that's a quite good thing about, because the Wii is all about family time, but quite often you don't all want to be playing bowling with grandma and family time. So it's quite a nice way to be able to be with the family in the same room, but, you know, doing two different things.
I never to play bowling with grandma. That sounds like an amazing game.
I want to borrow a grandma so I can bowl her. I know that when this originally came out at the announcement, there wasn't really much showing off of, you know, super happy, fun smiles time and, you know, the next, you know, Mario game. It was like shooting people in the head and car racing.
Yes.
Bit uncharacteristic of Nintendo.
Yes. I mean, there's only one console ago on the GameCube. They had this sort of stuff and then they've sort of completely vanished anything with a gun in it from their record, and they've gone for a very family-friendly thing. So it's quite weird to sort of open the show and see, like, Darksiders with demons having their heads slashed off and things like that. And Metro is like, since when would that be on a Nintendo console?
Definitely. Right. Before we wrap up the E3 stuff, I want to have a little whip round and find out what everyone's most anticipated game or thing that was announced from E3 was, or least favourite. Duncan.
You want to start with me?
I'm going to start with you.
I'll probably say Journey, which is a PSN title published by That Game Company, who also did a game called Flower and another one called... what was it called? It was called Flow, wasn't it? Yeah. And all that they've shown off so far is a trailer, and it's kind of it's a bit of a not game, really. It's you wander around this desert with a mountain off in the distance, and the objective is to sort of travel towards the mountain. But it's all about the experience of walking around this desert, sliding down the sand dunes, and so on. There's no gunfights, there's no explosions, there's none of that. It's very calming and just gentle.
One of the amazing things about it is that it'll chuck someone in from the PlayStation Network, but there's no voice chat and you don't get to know their name. So you sort of have to just work together through, like, gestures and sort of figuring it out together. It's sort of like a play on cultural differences or finding someone who doesn't speak the same language. So it'd be quite an interesting way to play.
Mark, what was your highlight? Was your E3
I like
happy?
The look of Tomb Raider. I'm always a big Tomb Raider fan. Crystal Dynamics, who's a sort of San Franciscan company, has had the Tomb Raider license for a long time, but they've sort of been just sort of porting the same Tomb Raider game out over and over again, and now this time they've done that whole new thing where she's like a little girl. She's on an island full of mud.
I think she's 21 in this one, Lara Croft.
Yeah, a lot of mud, lots of sex noises, as you're saying, when she gets hit.
Mud wrestling and sex noises.
Yes.
I was saying this earlier. In the demo that they showed off, it was just a stream of Lara Croft covered in filth, explosions everywhere, and her making sex noises as pain noises the whole time. I mean, it looks amazing.
Yeah, it looks like sort of, it's sort of like horror stuff. They've got a lot more sort of gritty darkness in there, which is always fun.
I have to say, I'm with you on that. Tomb Raider is one I'm looking for. I mean, I don't think it's going to be out until next year sometime, 2012.
Yeah, 2012.
But it's definitely going to be one to watch. And I think there are quite a lot of people watching what they're doing with Tomb Raider because the last few haven't necessarily lived up to expectation.
What's your favourite from E3, Nate?
I'm going to give you a guess. Go on.
Was it Final Fantasy
yes.
13 X2? Duodecim 59874?
Yeah, that's enough. Final Fantasy 13 2, which is the sequel to Final Fantasy 13, which a lot of people didn't like. I thought it was a great game. I thought it was a bad Final Fantasy game, but it was a fun game nonetheless. And we got hands-on time. One of the US wide writers got hands-on time with Final Fantasy 10-2 and said that there are a number of ways that 10-2 is looking like it's trying to redeem itself over Final Fantasy 13, and basically
by 10-2 do you mean 13-2?
Sorry, 13-2, yeah, and kind of taking all the things that they did right with 13-2, so things like the battle system, the graphics, and a lot of the characters, but then bringing back in a lot of the stuff that people really missed. One of them is that they're going to be having these like new non-linear areas to explore, so think towns and people. So one of the big things about Final Fantasy and a lot of RPGs is that you can walk into towns and villages and just chat to people, and you didn't have to do it, but if you wanted to, you could. So we're going to have that back in 13-2. And also, quite interestingly, you're going to be able to get enemies that you fight to join your party so they can fight other enemies with you. Like, so they're walking around the field with you, which I thought was quite cool. And also more puzzles, which 13 just didn't really have any of, really. A lot of puzzle sections.
So what they're doing is kind of taking it back to its roots almost, is that?
It seems that they're taking it back more to where Final Fantasy was about 7 or 8 years ago, sort of in the likes of Final Fantasy X, something like that. It wasn't quite that long ago, but about 2000 and... It might have been that long ago. Anyway, quite a while ago. But keeping all the things that were really good about 13. So I'm really excited about this. This is my number one thing, but I'm a bit sad like that. Not everyone will agree. But there we go. So Tomb Raider, Final Fantasy 13 2. I'm surprised you didn't mention Mass Effect 3, Duncan, actually.
Yeah, I'm excited about Mass Effect 3.
Because that's going to be on PC as well, and you were always hot about getting PC games from E3.
Yeah. I mean, I'm excited about that. I mean, you told me to pick one thing, so I picked one thing. But if I'd picked five, that would definitely have been in there.
We don't have time for five. In fact, we don't have time for very much more at all.
Do we have time for a favourite from Olivia?
Go on then, Liv.
Well, I mean, as you boys know, I'm not as big into gaming or I'm remotely as big into gaming as you are. But I think the Vita sounds interesting. I think that could tempt me to part with my cash.
I agree. I think the Vita is, without question, probably the hottest piece of hardware from E3. And it's going to be out at the end of the year. So
time for Christmas.
Time for Christmas. But on that note, we are wrapping up the show. Liv, now you're back from Oz. Tell people how they can contact all of us.
Well, you can catch us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK. Nate is @NateLangson. Duncan is @DuncanGear. Mark is @BritishGaming, as we discussed earlier, and I am @Olivia_Solon.
Are you going to change your @BritishGaming now that we've established that you can?
I might do. If I do, I'm definitely having an underscore.
Yes. Hell yes. Yes to the underscores. Underscore I'm proud.
You can email us on podcast@wired.co.uk. We love getting your emails. We read every single one. They make us jump for joy in the office every single time we get one.
Or you could email us, as we asked earlier, for which marine animal you would like to represent the endangered species of the seas.
It's got to be the giant squid.
It has got to be the seahorse.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us this week.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to go and have a beer now, and we will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Have you got your squid ready? I don't mean.
It's ready and waiting.
Get your squid
it's
out.
Primed, full of ink.
So wrong, and yet so right.